Blog Talk Hello Radio. And,
hello and welcome to our show. Tonight we're having a guest,
Living
Gayoni.
Out Loud. It's hosted by
Dr. Frida.
Frida.
Let's do this again. Let's do a 3-2-1 because we've got your intro coming in first.
Okay, then I'm not going to talk at all till you introduce
to
me.
Yeah, to the intro coming in. Okay, we'll do it. And we'll reiterate this. And 3-2-1.
Living Out Loud is hosted by Dr. Frida Birnbaum, a research psychologist, psychoanalyst, and author of What Price Power? An In-Depth Study of Professional Women in a Relationship. She's an expert on depression, women's issues, and attaining happiness. Dr. Birnbaum has been featured on Oprah 2020 in some of the biggest TV radio venues in the world. Now, without further ado, here's your host of Living Out Loud, Dr. Frida Birnbaum.
Hello, everyone, and welcome, and thank you so much. Our guest today is Dr. Gayoni De Silva, and she will be speaking about children and her psychiatry and her special way of treating children who need medications. And while we are waiting, we will discuss some of the events that are going on. We're talking about Bruce Jenner, what's going on with him. And it looks like our guest is ready. So Bruce Jenner is going to have to wait, and hopefully we'll talk about him in a little while. So we would like to welcome Dr. Gayoni De Silva. Is that how I pronounce it? Am I pronouncing it right?
It's close. It's Dr. Gayoni De Silva.
Oh, okay. So close, but not close enough.
No, it's good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the
welcome.
Show.
Welcome. Our pleasure. So, you know, this is a very interesting topic about the way children are being treated with, attention deficits and the medications and the underlying problems. Isn't it true that intercity kids often have more behavioral problems because of the deficit with after-school activities and connectedness with others? So it does stem from a lot of behavioral issues. Would you agree with that?
I think that behavioral issues are both a product of the environment and biology, so genetics, the home situation, the school situation, the after-school situation. And whenever there's a deficit in a child's needs, be it mental illness or be it spiritual, be it family needs or developmental needs, then they tend to act out in behavioral maladaptive ways.
So with those problems, as far as parents are concerned, what's going on lately? It seems to be the children are having more problems and there is more behavioral issues. And as far as medication, that's also a problem. It seems that there are a lot of side effects. I've even read that it affects your heart. These medications can be dangerous as well. So we're talking about, you know, all ranges of help. Let's start with parents and what they can do to helpful to their children. I'm sorry?
It does seem like there are more problems and more behavioral problems. I think there are two aspects to that, or a couple of aspects. One is that we are more aware of the experience that children are having as they're growing, and we're paying more attention to their development, how they're doing in school, what the actual dynamics are in the classroom. And we're looking at what the dynamics are in the home. A lot of parents have to go to work. Both parents go to work now. And so a lot of kids are in after-school programs, so we're able to observe them there too. So I think the problem is a little bit complicated. I don't think it's just I don't think it's a matter of poor parenting. I think it's a matter of learning how to parent in this society, in this climate these days, with these economic stressors, with more parents going back to work, with less parents at home, with more use of after-school programs, more use of babysitting and other services.
Do you feel that boys have more emotional problems than women, girls?
No, it's actually 50-50 for boys and girls. There is a discrepancy as boys and girls grow a little bit older in the teenage years than it seems to be like teenage girls have a little bit more psychiatric illness than boys. But in the childhood, elementary school age, it's 50-50.
What about Asperger's? You know, it's been on the rise, and it's been spoken about the fact that young boys are influenced by connecting with the masculine side of themselves and their fathers, and there seems to be a deficit. What can you tell us about this?
Well, you know, we have a new categorizing system for mental illness and developmental disorders, which is called autism spectrum disorder. So I think in the current climate of diagnosing, we're going to include a lot of people in this range, and we're not going to be diagnosing people according to autism, Asperger's, or pervasive developmental disorder as we had done in the past. And I think this is really to understand. Well, I think the aim of this broad category is really to understand what development is all about for kids and where the problems are and how we can intervene and how we can develop resources and systems and programs to meet every child's needs. You know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, we may have just thought that children were quirky or had learning disabilities or were just kind of out of the normal range of kids, and they weren't really mm-hmm. tended to, and their needs, their developmental needs, their educational needs, and their social needs were kind of left to chance. You know, there was no intervention. And so now we have this opportunity to really include more kids into this diagnosis, if you will, in order to get services and understand them and to meet their needs.
So how do you diagnose these kids? You know, there's so many areas. And I was reading that you wrote that you really have to see the difference between sleep disorders, hyperactivity. You know, where do these kids fall into different categories?
Yes, so it's a really complicated assessment process. It takes a lot of time. And and so what I do is I first start with what the parents and the child present in my office, so whatever the presenting complaint is. So they may come in and say, oh, my child's not sleeping. How do I get him to sleep? And then I think about all the different ways that sleep can be affected, and then I ask some screening questions. And then I sort of delve down deeper as the screening questions, whether they answer yes or no, and try to hone down a diagnosis. But with children, since they're so young and so much is going on with them, I have to keep a very broad perspective of what the diagnoses might be and what the problems might be. And it might not even be with the child. You know, it might not be that the child has a sleep disorder, but it might be that there are issues in the home or maybe some sleep rituals that can be instituted to help with sleep. Or maybe there's a nutritional issue.
Well, that's very interesting. But, you know, lately psychiatry is being frowned upon with the medications, with the side effects. What do you tell parents when they're concerned about the side effects of these medications, or their children are not completely themselves and they don't like that as well?
Important question about medication, because medications are so powerful, and the medications we use are not studied all that much in children, if at all. So we're kind of extrapolating data used or gained from studies with adults, and then in our own clinical practice, and then the knowledge that we have from other child psychiatrists and providers. So those medications have long-term side effects. They have problems with developing diabetes, increased cholesterolemia, cardiac effects, obesity, and movement disorders. So we need to use them very judiciously. And so it's really important to find out why a child has a particular behavior, if it's neurological, if it's biological, if it's psychological or spiritual, and then and then address it in that way. And if we can address behavioral issues with a therapy or a modality that doesn't include medication, then that's the way we need to go.
And at what point would you recommend a neurologist where you feel that that child needs, you know, further testing?
I recommend neurologists and neuropsychologists whenever I sense that there is an actual, like, neurological problem, whenever there's a neurological deficit. So if there's any sort of movement disorder, if there's any sort of like difficulty with processing in the brain, processing information, then I would want some neuropsych testing.
Interesting. So if there's sleep disorders, it could be neurologically based, anything that the child is not able to really have some control over, it could be something that needs really further investigation. Now, you deal with foster homes, is that right?
I do. I have a lot of patients who are in the foster care system. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And what difference do you see in that kind of environment, as opposed to?
Well, first of all,
yes.
Most of the foster kids have had trauma, some sort of trauma, whether it be physical trauma, sexual abuse, neglect, emotional abuse, or they've witnessed domestic violence in the home. So they come in with reactions and neurological reactions to the trauma, which actually creates kind of like brain damage, you know, injuries in the brain and development of normal cognitive processes and normal psychological processes. So that's the first thing to think about when we think about taking care of kids in the foster care system. The other thing is their setting. So a lot of these kids move from one home to another home to another home, and they have difficulty forming attachments to people and developing a sense of basic trust. And then they're in homes that sometimes have multiple kids who have very significant needs, whether they're medical needs or psychological needs. And there might be six kids in a home. There might be eight kids. I once took care of some children in a home with 12 children in the home with just two parents. And, you know, we need to assess the ability of the parents to take care of these kids with special needs.
So what kind of treatment, what kind of advice would you give these kinds of institutionalized settings where these children don't appear or end up so damaged?
Well, in the foster care system right now, we do over-medicate kids in order to mollify them or to sedate them or to diminish their symptoms enough that they're able to be managed by their foster home. So, I mean, my advice would be, number one, to support parents from the very beginning to take care of their children. So they really have good aftercare care, like babysitting and daycare for kids, for parents who have difficulties with parenting, have good parenting classes, have parent partners go into the home to help them with behavioral issues and with emotional issues and really help them learn to be good parents and take care of their own issues so that they can provide for their children. And then when the children go into foster care, for the foster care system to carefully screen and train their foster parents so that they're aware of what kinds of behaviors and emotional needs these kids have so that they're not overwhelmed by them. Because I find a lot of foster parents become overwhelmed, especially when they have too many kids in the home. If you have a foster parent who's very well-meaning, and they only have maybe one or two children in the home, they do a very good job and these kids feel loved and nurtured and their needs are met. And that's really what they need, is their needs to get met. And so if a parent is unable to meet their needs, the system can be developed to rectify that situation.
So this is so interesting. So how can you actually tell the difference between a child who is chemically imbalanced and a child who just may be emotionally distressed?
Well, the emotional distress does cause a chemical imbalance, so they're very intimately intertwined. So by helping the chemistry, we do help reduce the emotional reactivity so that the patient or the child can utilize the resources, the therapy, and the support that's outside of medication.
That sounds wonderful, and I agree with that because it's always the underlying problem that when there's a chemical imbalance, it's because of some emotional trauma that induces that most of the time. I mean, it's often hereditary as well, but you still need to deal with the behavioral process to break the cycle. So I think it works both ways.
I think that trauma and experience affects the brain and affects the chemistry of the brain, so that when the child and the brain gets overwhelmed by too much trauma or too much stress, then the chemistry changes and the chemistry can overwhelm the brain, and then we develop a disorder. So it's
exactly.
A little bit of, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is it a mental disorder, a hereditary mental disorder that came first, or the environment and experience that causes it?
That's so true. But even if it's hereditary, don't you think that it was induced in some way with the environment around you, and that then it became hereditary and genetically oriented as generations pass from one to another? I mean, it's a, you know, we go around in circles with that question always. So, you know, I'll give you a break, and we don't even have to go there. There's so many other questions to ask. So, you know, we're looking at medication, and we're looking at, you know, who to give it to, how much to give, because it's such a delicate balance of over-medicating the child, giving the child enough to make sure that that is something that is going to make a difference. How do you go about doing that? What is your decision-making process on that?
Well, I always start low, basically to minimize side effects, and then I see the child often, maybe once a week, maybe sometimes twice a week, maybe every 2 weeks, every 4 weeks. It all depends on how they react. Whenever I start a medication, I always see them within 2 weeks because I want to know about side effects, I want to know about the effect, and then I also know about what we can expect from the medications. You know, some medications don't take a full effect for 2 months or 3 months. So just knowing how the medications work, what the research has been, what the studies have shown, and how patients react to the medication, we have to take all of that information and use it whenever I see a child. And it's just really frequent visits. You know, it's not appropriate to give a medication to a child and then have them come back to the office 3 months later. You have no idea what's going on.
That's so important to continue the treatment. Really, that's the only way you can really get to know the person that's coming to see you. So what would you tell a parent who has a child who has some social anxiety, maybe some sleep disorders, digestive problems, let's see what else I can think of there, does not feel comfortable being with other people? Would that be something that you would feel medication would be in order?
Possibly.
Would
I would want to see the child.
Possibly.
I would either want the child to be seen by me or by a therapist to further assess and evaluate the details about the anxiety, about the stomach ache, about avoidance of other people. Because I could
sleep disorder.
It could be an anxiety disorder, it could be a psychotic disorder, it could be a mood disorder, you know, it could be a learning disorder.
Well, you know, often these kids who have some of these disorders are very bright.
Yeah.
So they have deficits on one side, their brain imbalance, you know, left side, right side, there's an imbalance. And often these kids who are very bright also don't have the social cues to be able to function. You know, they even have in my area, it's called the Brain Balance Center. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of that.
And that's a treatment center where these kids come in and they are taught how to use their bodies, how to respond appropriately, and how to be able to visualize. They say if there's an eye that is weak, that could also affect the process of your brain functioning. Is that true? And tell me what you think of that.
Well, I think that the brain controls everything. We have nerves that go out to every part of our bodies, and we have nerves that take input in and take it to our brain. Our brain synthesizes all this information that, you know, we can't even quantify. We don't even know all the data that our brain takes in. You know, we're not aware of it. But our brain takes in all sorts of little data and then synthesizes an action plan. So if there's some part of our bodies, our senses that aren't taking in as much as another part, then the brain will make accommodations for that. So sure. I do agree with that.
Yeah, so there's a process, and it takes about, I don't know, twice a week, 6 months, but it's really amazing how they can change a child around just by, and listening to music, how they can allow that child to use that other side of their brain to develop a balance in their lives. And this is something that could have been chemically induced, but they're treating it in a much more behavioral way. But I just want to thank you for being on our show. It was very interesting.
You're welcome.
Gayani De Silva.
Yes.
I want to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. For me, too. For me too.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Hey. Doing great. I really enjoyed that interview. It was pretty amazing how, you know, you really do learn about how badly these kids are over-medicated and basically, you know, some of the things are out there. So it's fascinating.
It's very sad. And there's so many parents out there who have this. And, you know, statistically, it's more and more. And they really want to know what to do. They are really looking for advice. Not only that, they do have gone for professional help. And they haven't even been helped. As we were talking about, the kids are over-medicated. It can affect their hearts and do damage to them and or other internal organs. So it's really very scary that we don't always have, even if we try to help our children, the right resources. We were fortunate to have Dr. De Silva, who is really focused on, psychiatry and children and what to do about this. So this is something else that I hope I'm helping people.
You're bringing a lot of things to their attention. And Frida, wanted to ask you this, is that now if you live in a society, if you have a society that's, let's say, becoming more tyrannical or more repressive of rights, and then you have children who are just being children and they're free, they're running around and they're just questioning everything, do you feel that a lot of these situations where a kid could be diagnosed with a disorder or a psychotic disorder could be a direct reflection of the attitudes of that society, which maybe seem to, embrace a controlled environment as opposed to freedom, which most kids generally have? So what I'm saying is that, do you think that more kids are being diagnosed with mental disorders based on something that they just are in their natural state?
You make a great father because you really have insight, and that's a fantastic question. Absolutely. You know, we could really learn from our childhood and who we used to be. Because being carefree, even when children move around a lot, it's really healthy to be physical and to be playful and to be inquisitive. All this is what helps your mind to grow and helps you to learn about the world. So it's very sad when parents come into play and want their children to behave, whatever that means. But, you know, we grew up with our id. And our id is instinctual. Then we learn to be defensive, and then our ego steps in. And we have to be egocentric because we have to get along in the world. But the sad thing is, you're right. Being a child and being playful and being out there is really what it's all about. And if parents stifle their kids and they're hard on their children, they are going to do damage. And I hope parents who are listening and who want to do the right thing, being authoritative, and that's what those parents are called, are not the right way to be. This is not the way you're going to bring up well-adjusted, happy people.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a story that came out this week. I think you made a really great point, Dr. Frida. You know, we're thinking about all these people talking about disorders, talking about people who you're examining as far as questioning their mental capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talk this week about Bruce Jenner. Apparently he's doing some big interview with Diane Sawyer, and we talked earlier, and the question I asked you was that, is Bruce Jenner doing this for public attention, or is he authentic, or is he going through a genuine transition? So I was wondering if you could please elaborate. Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I don't know who on earth would want to do this for public attention unless they're really, their mind is really warped. I mean, it's true, his family has sort of taken the spotlight, but to go ahead and disfigure your body and go through such lengths of pain, you really have to see Dr. DeSilva in order to do that. But realistically, this is something that he has been carrying around, and his family can attest to that, for years and years. When he had his first surgery, which was his nose, it did have a feminine quality to it as well. So this is a time for him to come out. I guess he doesn't feel like he's losing out on anything. And it's true, it is a way of getting attention. He didn't have to do it quite this way. He didn't have to do it in a celebrity manner, but this is something that was timing. After all, he got a divorce from his wife. The show is not doing well. He was not a big part of it, and he was basically kicked out of it. So where is he to go? So here is something that is actually going on with him, and he's deciding to make it public. So he's really somebody who has the need to change, and he has the need to identify himself differently sexually. I mean, that's innate. That's something that we're born with, and we have to be true to ourselves. So this is something else that's going to go on in our society, because if he goes ahead and does this, and if he is supported in some way, other people will feel more comfortable to go ahead and do the same thing.
Yeah, I think you made a really good point about that. Because, I mean, if people see that he's coming out doing it and he's taking on the public scrutiny, he could be a trailblazer for other people who are doing this.
Absolutely. We always need people that will do something different. And it's hard to be the one to defy whatever is going on around you, because there's a stigma. You're not going to be supported. You're going to be looked at as weird. And you won't have the connectedness that you had before. But that's a risk we all have to take. And it's a prime example of being who you are and being true to yourself.
You know, when Bruce Jenner is doing this and he's out there and he's constantly making it public, do you find that he may be looking for some kind of reassurance and public support and to make them feel good, because maybe he's having a hard time doing it himself? Do you feel that if he can maybe see public, that the public is supporting him, that he might be able to accept himself? Do you feel he's a person who accepts himself for who he is?
Well, he's been out there for a long time. After all, he was a pro. And so he's used to the media around him. So this is just something else that he's doing with the media, because he's getting attention. Is he doing it for approval? I think he's doing it more for a way of being seen and a way of getting his needs met over his family, who is so visible. As far as approval is concerned, we all need approval with whatever we do in our lives. And wouldn't that be great? And he would be discovered anyway. We all know who he is. If he's going through this transformation, he's going to be someone that's going to be in the news and in the media. What he's actually doing is he's taking control over it. He's saying, hey, look, you're not going to stalk me. Well, they'll do that anyway or make fun of me. But I'm going to do it in such a way that I'm going to be confident about my stance and what this means. And therefore, he's going to project that to other people. So I think it's more of a control issue of who he wants to be, and he's finally speaking out, and he finally has a voice of something that's been stagnant inside him for many, many years. So in that way, I do give him a lot of credit for taking this road, because this is something that most people would not do. He's being interviewed, he's speaking about it, he's letting other people know that it's all right. And, you know, we really have to give him credit for going out there and making himself so vulnerable, even though there could be a big stigma connected to who Bruce Jenner will be from now on. So I really want to thank you so much, our audience, for listening to our show. I'm looking forward to having just a wonderful, exceptional show next time and just better things to come. Be well, and thank you for listening.